This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome back to readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. As we complete part three of the book, Jordan Jacob and Mike Rumble are the readers. As we move into part four, Stuart Jonap will be reading the first chapter. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
Chapter 8. Jude wondered if she had really left her handkerchief behind, or whether it were that she had miserably wished to tell him of a love that at the last moment she could not bring herself to express. He could not stay in his silent lodging when they were gone, and fearing that he might be tempted to drown his misery in alcohol, he went upstairs, changed his dark clothes for his white, his thin boots for his thick, and proceeded to his customary work for the afternoon. But in the cathedral he seemed to hear a voice behind him, and to be possessed with that idea that she would come back. She could not possibly go home with Phillotson, he fancied. The feeling grew and stirred. The moment that the clock struck the last of his working hours, he threw down his tools and rushed homeward. "Has anybody been for me?" he asked. Nobody had been there. As he could claim the downstairs sitting room till 12 o'clock that night, he sat in it all the evening, and when the clock had struck 11 and the family had retired, he could not shake off the feeling that she would come back and sleep in the little room adjoining his own, in which she had slept so many previous days. Her actions were always unpredictable. Why should she not come? Gladly would he have compounded for the denial of her as a sweetheart and wife by having her live thus as a fellow lodger and friend, even on the most distant terms. His supper still remained spread, and going to the front door and softly setting it open, he returned to the room and sat as watchers sit on old midsummer eves, expecting the phantom of the beloved. But she did not come. Having indulged in this wild hope, he went upstairs and looked out the window, and pictured her through the evening journey to London, whither she and Phillotson had gone there for holiday. There rattling along through the damp cold night to their hotel, under the same sky of ribbed cloud as that he beheld, through which the moon showed its position rather than its shape, and one or two of the larger stars made themselves visible as faint nebulae only. It was a new beginning of Sue's history. He projected his mind into the future, and saw her with children more or less in her own likeness around her. But the consolation of regarding them as a continuation of her identity was denied to him, as to all such dreamers, by the willfulness of nature in not only allowing issue from one parent alone. Every desired renewal of an existence is debased by being half alloy. If at the estrangement or death of my lost love I could go and see her child, hers solely, there would be comfort in it, said Jude. And then he again uneasily saw, as he had latterly seen with more and more frequency, the scorn of nature's for man's finer emotions, and her lack of interest in his aspirations. The oppressive strength of his affection for Sue showed itself on the morrow and following days yet more clearly. He could no longer endure the light of the Melchester lamps. The sunshine was as drab paint, and the blue sky as zinc. Then he received news that his old aunt was dangerously ill at Marygreen, which intelligence almost coincided with a letter from his former employer at Christminster, who offered him permanent work of a good class if he would come back. The letters were almost a relief to him. He started to visit Aunt Drusilla, and resolved to go onward to Christminster to see what worth there might be in the builder's offer. Jude found his aunt even worse than the communication from the Widow Edlund had led him to expect. There was every possibility of her lingering on for weeks or months, though little likelihood. He wrote to Sue, informing her of the state of her aunt, and suggesting that she might like to see her aged relative alive. He would meet her at Alfredston Road the following evening, Monday, on his way back from Christminster, if she could come up by the up train, which crossed his down train at that station. Next morning, accordingly, he went on to Christminster, intending to return to Alfredston soon enough to keep the suggested appointment with Sue. The city of learning wore an estranged look, and he had lost all feeling for its associations. Yet as the sun made vivid lights and shades of the mullioned architecture of the facades, and drew patterns of the crinkled battlements on the young turf of the quadrangles, Jude thought he had never seen the place look more beautiful. He came to the street in which he had first beheld Sue. The chair she had occupied when, leaning over her ecclesiastical scrolls, a hog-hair brush in her hand, her girlish figure had arrested the gaze of his inquiring eyes, stood precisely in its former spot, empty. It was as if she were dead, and nobody had been found capable of succeeding her in that artistic pursuit. Hers was now the city phantom, while those of the intellectual and devotional worthies who had once moved him to emotion were no longer able to assert their presence there. However, here he was, and in fulfillment of his intention, he went on to his former lodgings in Beersheba, near the ritualistic church of St. Silas. The old landlady who opened the door seemed glad to see him again, and bringing some lunch informed him that the builder who had employed him had called to inquire his address. Jude went on to the stone yard where he had worked, but the old sheds and bankers were distasteful to him. He felt it impossible to engage himself to return and stay in this place of vanished dreams. He longed for the hour of the homeward train to Alfredston, where he might probably meet Sue. Then for one ghastly half-hour of depression caused by these scenes, there returned upon him that feeling which had been his undoing more than once, that he was not worth the trouble of being taken care of either by himself or others. And during this half-hour he met Tinker Taylor, the bankrupt ecclesiastical ironmonger at Fourways, who proposed that they should adjourn to a bar and drink together. They walked along the street till they stood before one of the great palpitating centres of Christminster life, the inn wherein he formerly had responded to the challenge to rehearse the creed in Latin, now a popular tavern with a spacious and inviting entrance, which gave admittance to a bar that had been entirely renovated and refitted in modern style since Jude's residence here. Tinker Taylor drank off his glass and departed, saying it was too stylish a place now for him to feel at home in, unless he was drunker than he had money to be just then. Jude was longer finishing his, and stood abstractly silent in the, for the minute, almost empty place. The bar had been gutted and newly arranged throughout, mahogany fixtures having taken the place of the old painted ones, while at the back of the standing space there were stuffed sofa benches. The room was divided into compartments in the approved manner, between which were screens of ground glass and mahogany framing, to prevent toppers in one compartment being put to the blush by the recognitions of those in the next. On the inside of the counter, two barmaids leaned over the white-handled beer engines and the row of the little silver taps inside, dripping into a pewter trough. Feeling tired and having nothing more to do till the train left, Jude sat down on one of the sofas. At the back of the barmaids rose beveled-edged mirrors, with glass shelves running along their front, on which stood precious liquids that Jude did not know the name of, in bottles of topaz, sapphire, ruby, and amethyst. The moment was enlivened by the entrance of some customers into the next compartment and the starting of the mechanical telltale of monies received, which emitted a ting-ting every time a coin was put in. The barmaid attending to this compartment was invisible to Jude's direct glance, though a reflection of her back in the glass behind her was occasionally caught by his eyes. He had only observed this listlessly when she turned her face for a moment to the glass to set her hair tidy. Then he was amazed to discover that the face was Arabella's. If she had come on to his compartment, she would have seen him, but she did not, this being presided over by the maiden on the other side. Abby was in a black gown, with white linen cuffs and a broad white collar, and her figure, more developed than formerly, was accentuated by a bunch of daffodils that she wore on her left bosom. In the compartment she served stood an electroplated fountain of water over a spirit lamp, whose blue flame sent a steam from the top, all this being visible to him only in the mirror behind her, which also reflected the faces of the men she was attending to, one of them a handsome, dissipated young fellow, possibly an undergraduate, who had been relating to her an experience of some humorous sort. "Oh, Mr. Cockman, now, how can you tell such a tale to me in my innocence?" she cried gaily. "Mr. Cockman, what do you use to make your mustache curl so beautiful?" As the young man was clean-shaven, the retort provoked a laugh at his expense. "Come," said he, "I'll have a curacao, and a light, please." She served the liquor from one of the lovely bottles, and, striking a match, held it to his cigarette with ministering archness while he whiffed. "Well, have you heard from your husband lately, my dear?" he asked. "Not a sound," said she. "Where is he?" "I left him in Australia, and I suppose he's there still." Jude's eyes grew rounder. "What made you part from him? Don't you ask questions, and you won't hear lies. Come, then, give me my change, which you've been keeping from me for the last quarter of an hour, and I'll romantically vanish up the streets of this picturesque city." She handed the change over the counter, in taking which he caught her fingers and held them. There was a slight struggle and a titter, and he bade her good-bye and left. Jude had looked on with the eye of a dazed philosopher. It was extraordinary how far removed from his life Arabella now seemed to be. He could not realize their nominal closeness. And this being the case, in his present frame of mind, he was indifferent to the fact that Arabella was his wife indeed. The compartment that she served emptied itself of visitors, and after a brief thought he entered it, and went forward to the counter. Arabella did not recognize him for a moment. Then their glances met, she started, till a humorous impudence sparkled in her eyes, and she spoke. "Well, I'm blessed. I thought you were underground years ago." "Oh, I never heard anything of you, or I don't know that I should have come here, but never mind." What shall I treat you to this afternoon? A scotch and a soda? Come, anything that the house will afford, for old acquaintance' sake. Thanks, Arabella, said Jude, without a smile. But I don't want anything more than I've had. The fact was that her unexpected presence there had destroyed at a stroke his momentary taste for strong liquor as completely as if it had whisked him back to his milk-fed infancy. That's a pity. Now you could get it for nothing. How long have you been here?
About 6 weeks. I returned from Sydney 3 months ago. I always liked this business, you know.
I wonder you came to this place.
Well, as I say, I thought you were gone to glory, and being in London, I saw the situation in an advertisement. Nobody was likely to know me here, even if I had minded, for I was never in Christminster in my growing up.
Why did you return from Australia?
Oh, I had my reasons. Then you are not a don yet?
No.
Not even a reverend?
No.
Nor so much as a rather reverend dissenting gentleman?
I am as I was.
True, you look so.
She idly allowed her fingers to rest on the pull of the beer engine as she inspected him critically. He observed that her hands were smaller and whiter than when he had lived with her, and that on the hand which pulled the engine she wore an ornamental ring set with what seemed to be real sapphires, which they were, indeed, and were much admired as such by the young man who frequented the bar.
"So you pass as having a living husband?" he continued.
"Yes, I thought it might be awkward if I called myself a widow, as I should have liked."
"True, I am known here a little."
"I didn't mean on that account, for as I said, I didn't expect you. It was for other reasons."
"What were they?"
"I don't care to go into them," she replied evasively. "I make a very good living, and I don't know that I want your company." Here, a chappie with no chin and a mustache like a lady's eyebrow came and asked for a curiously compounded drink, and Arabella was obliged to go and attend to him.
"We can't talk here," she said, stepping back a moment.
"Can't you wait till 9? Say yes and don't be a fool. I can get off duty 2 hours sooner than usual if I ask. I am not living in the house at present." He reflected and said gloomily, "I'll come back. I suppose we'd better arrange something?"
"Oh, bother arranging. I'm not going to arrange anything."
"But I must know a thing or two. And as you say, we can't talk here."
"Very well. I'll call for you."
Depositing his unemptied glass, he went out and walked up and down the street. Here was a rude flounce into the pellucid sentimentality of his sad attachment to Sue. Though Arabella's word was absolutely untrustworthy, he thought there might be some truth in her implication that she had not wished to disturb him, and had really supposed him dead. However, there was only one thing now to be done, and that was to play a straightforward part, the law being the law, and the woman between whom and himself there no more unity than between East and West being in the eye of the church one person with him. Having to meet Arabella here, it was impossible to meet Sue at Alfredston as he had promised. At every thought of this, a pang had gone through him, but the conjecture could not be helped. Arabella was perhaps an intended intervention to punish him for his unauthorized love. Passing the evening, therefore, in a desultory waiting about the town wherein he avoided the precincts of every cloister and hall, because he could not bear to behold them, he repaired to the tavern bar while the 101 strokes were resounding from the great bell of Cardinal College, a coincidence which seemed to him gratuitous irony. The inn was now brilliantly lighted up, and the scene was altogether more brisk and gay. The faces of the barmaidens had risen in color, each having a pink flush on her cheek. Their manners were still more vivacious than before, more abandoned, more excited, more sensuous, and they expressed their sentiments and desire less euphemistically, laughing in a lackadaisical tone, without reserve. The bar had been crowded with men of all sorts during the previous hour, and he had heard from without the hubbub of their voices, but the customers were fewer at last. He nodded to Arabella, and told her that she would find him outside the door when she came away.
"But you must have something with me first," she said with great good humor.
"Just an early nightcap, I always do.
Then you can go out and wait a minute, as it is best we should not be seen going together."
She drew a couple of liquor glasses of brandy, and though she had evidently, from her countenance, already taken in enough alcohol, either by drinking, or more probably from the atmosphere she had breathed for so many hours, she finished hers quickly. He also drank his, and went outside the house. In a few minutes she came, in a thick jacket and a hat with a black feather. "I live quite near," she said, taking his arm, "and can let myself in by a latchkey at any time. What arrangement do you want to come to?"
"Oh, none in particular," he answered, thoroughly sick and tired, his thoughts again reverting to Alfredston and the train he did not go by, the probable disappointment of Sue that he was not there when she arrived, and the missed pleasure of her company on the long and lonely climb by starlight up the hills to Marygreen. "I ought to have gone back, really. My aunt is on her deathbed, I fear."
"I'll go over with you tomorrow morning. I think I could get a day off." There was something particularly uncongenial in the idea of Arabella, who had no more sympathy than a tigress with his relations, or him coming to the bedside of his dying aunt and meeting Sue. Yet he said, "Of course. If you'd like to, you can." "Well, that we'll consider. Now, until we have to come to some agreement, it is awkward our being together here, where you are known, and I am getting known, though without any suspicion that I have anything to do with you. As we are going to the station, suppose we take the 9:40 train to Aldbrickham. We shall be there in little more than half an hour, and nobody will know us for one night, and we shall be quite free to act as we choose till we have made up our minds whether we'll make anything public or not. As you like. Then wait till I get two or three things. This is my lodging. Sometimes when late, I sleep at the hotel where I am engaged, so nobody will think anything of my staying out." She speedily returned, and they went on to the railway, and made the half-hour's journey to Aldbrickham, where they entered a third-rate inn near the station in time for a late supper.
Chapter 9. On the morrow, between 9 and half past, they were journeying back to Christminster, the only two occupants of a compartment in a third-class railway carriage. Having, like Jude, made a rather hasty toilette to catch the train, Arabella looked a little frowsy, and her face was very far from possessing the animation which had characterized it at the bar the night before. When they came out of the station, she found that she still had half an hour to spare before she was due at the bar. They walked in silence a little way out of the town in the direction of Alfredston. Jude looked up the far highway. "Ah, poor feeble me," he murmured at last. "What?" said she. "This is the very road by which I came into Christminster years ago, full of plans. Well, whatever the road is, I think my time is nearly up, as I have to be in the bar by 11 o'clock. And as I said, I shan't ask for the day to go with you to see your aunt. So perhaps we had better part here. I'd sooner not walk up Cheap Street with you, since we've come to no conclusion at all." "Very well. But you said, when we were getting up this morning, that you had something you wished to tell me before I left." "So I had. Two things. One in particular. But you wouldn't promise to keep it a secret. I'll tell you now, if you promise. As an honest woman, I wish you to know it. It was what I began telling you in the night. About that gentleman who managed the Sydney Hotel. Arabella spoke somewhat hurriedly for her. You'll keep it close?" "Yes, I promise," said Jude impatiently. "Of course I don't want to reveal your secrets. Whenever I met him out for a walk, he used to say that he was much taken with my looks, and he kept pressing me to marry him. I never thought of coming back to England again, and being out there in Australia with no home of my own after leaving my father, I at last agreed, and did." "What, marry him?" "Yes." "Regularly? Legally? In church?" "Yes. And lived with him till shortly before I left. It was stupid, I know, but I did. There, now I've told you. Don't round upon me. He talks of coming back to England, poor old chap. But if he does, he won't be likely to find me." Jude stood pale and fixed. "Why the devil didn't you tell me last night?" he said. "Well, I didn't. Won't you make it up with me, then? So, in talking of your husband to the bar gentleman, you meant him, of course, not me." "Of course. Come, don't fuss about it." "I have nothing more to say," replied Jude. "I have nothing at all to say about the crime you confessed to." "Crime? Pooh! They don't think much of such as that over there. Lots of 'em do it. Well, if you take it like that, I shall go back to him. He was very fond of me, and we lived honorable enough, and as respectable as any married couple in the colony. How did I know where you were? I won't go blaming you. I could say a good deal, but perhaps it would be misplaced. What do you wish me to do?" "Nothing. There was one thing more I wanted to tell you, but I fancy we've seen enough of one another for the present. I shall think over what you said about your circumstances and let you know." Thus they parted. Jude watched her disappear in the direction of the hotel and entered the railway station close by, finding that it wanted 3/4 of an hour of the time at which he could get a train back to Alfredston. He strolled mechanically into the city as far as to the Four Ways, where he stood as he had so often stood before, and surveyed Cheap Street stretching ahead, with its college after college, in picturesqueness unrivaled except by such continental vistas as the Street of Palaces in Genoa, the lines of the buildings being as distinct in the morning air as in an architectural drawing. But Jude was far from seeing or criticizing these things. They were hidden by an indescribable consciousness of Arabella's midnight contiguity, a sense of degradation at his revived experiences with her, of her appearance as she lay asleep at dawn, which set upon his motionless face a look as of one accursed. If he could only have felt resentment towards her, he would have been less unhappy, but he pitied while he contemned her. Jude turned and retraced his step. Drawing again towards the station, he started at hearing his name pronounced, less at the name than at the voice. To his great surprise, no other than Sue stood like a vision before him, her look bodeful and anxious as in a dream, her little mouth nervous, and her strained eyes speaking reproachful inquiry. "Oh, Jude, I am so glad to meet you like this," she said in quick, uneven accents, not far from a sob. Then she flushed as she observed his thought that they had not met since her marriage. They looked away from each other to hide their emotion, took each other's hand without further speech, and went on together a while until she glanced at him with furtive solicitude. "I arrived at Alfredson Station last night, as you asked me to, and there was nobody to meet me. But I reached Mary Green alone, and they told me Aunt was a trifle better. I sat up with her, and as you did not come all night, I was frightened about you. I thought that perhaps, when you found yourself back in the old city, you were upset at thinking I was married and not there as I used to be, and that you had nobody to speak to. So you had tried to drown your gloom, as you did at the former time, when you were disappointed about entering as a student, and had forgotten your promise to me that you never would again. And this, I thought, was why you hadn't come to meet me. And you came to hunt me up and deliver me, like a good angel. I thought I would come by the morning train and try and find you, in case, I did think of my promise to you, dear, continually. I shall never break out again as I did, I am sure. I may have been doing nothing better, but I was not doing that. I loathe the thought of it. I am glad your staying had nothing to do with that. But," she said, the faintest pout entering into her tone, "you didn't come back last night and meet me as you engaged to." "I didn't, I am sorry to say. I had an appointment at 9 o'clock, too late for me to catch the train that would have met yours, or to get me home at all." Looking at his loved one as she appeared to him now in his tender thought, the sweetest and most disinterested comrade that he had ever had, living largely in vivid imagings, so ethereal a creature that his spirit could be seen trembling through her limbs, he felt heartily ashamed of his earthliness in spending the hours he had spent in Arabella's company. There was something rude and immoral in thrusting these recent facts of his life upon the mind of one who, to him, was so incarnate as to seem at times impossible as a human wife to any average man. And yet she was Phillotson's. How she had become such, how she lived as such, passed his comprehension as he regarded her today. "You'll go back with me?" he said. "There's a train just now. I wonder how my aunt is by this time. And so, Sue, you really came on my account all this way. At what an early time you must have started, poor thing." "Yes, sitting up watching alone made me all nerves for you, and instead of going to bed when it got light, I started. And now you won't frighten me like this again." He was not so sure that she had been frightened about his morals for nothing. He released her hand till they entered the train. It seemed the same carriage he had lately got out of with another, where they sat down side by side, Sue between him and the window. He regarded the delicate lines of her profile and the small, tight, apple-like convexities of her bodice, so different from Arabella's amplitudes. Though she knew he was looking at her, she did not turn to him, but kept her eyes forward as if afraid that by meeting his own, some troublous discussion would be initiated. "Sue, you are married now, you know, like me, and yet we have been in such a hurry that we have not said a word about it." "There's no necessity," she quickly returned. "Oh, well, perhaps not, but I wish." Jude, don't talk about me. I wish you wouldn't, she entreated. It distresses me, rather. Forgive my saying it. Where did you stay last night? She had asked the question in perfect innocence to change the topic. He knew that, and said merely, at an inn. Though it would have been a relief to tell her of his meeting with an unexpected one, but the latter's final announcement of her marriage in Australia bewildered him lest what he might say should do his ignorant wife an injury. Their talk proceeded, but awkwardly till they reached Alfredston. That Sue was not as she had been, but was labeled Phillotson, paralyzed Jude whenever he wanted to commune with her as an individual. Yet she seemed unaltered. He could not say why. There remained the 5-mile extra journey into the country, which it was just as easy to walk as to drive, the greater part of it being uphill. Jude had never before in his life gone that road with Sue, though he had with another. It was now as if he carried a bright light, which temporarily banished the shady associations of the earlier time. Sue talked, but Jude noticed that she still kept the conversation from herself. At length he inquired if her husband were well. "Oh, yes," she said. "He is obliged to be in the school all the day, or he would have come with me. He is so good and kind that to accompany me he would have dismissed the school for once, even against his principles, for he is strongly opposed to giving casual holidays, only I wouldn't let him. I felt it would be better to come alone. Aunt Drusilla, I knew, was so very eccentric, and his being almost a stranger to her now would have made it irksome to both. Since it turns out that she is hardly conscious, I am glad I did not ask him." Jude had walked moodily while this praise of Phillotson was being expressed. "Mr. Phillotson obliges you in everything as he ought," he said. "Of course. You ought to be a happy wife. And of course I am. Bride, I might almost have said, as yet, it is not so many weeks since I gave you to him, and—" "Yes, I know, I know." There was something in her face which belied her late assuring words, so strictly proper and so lifelessly spoken that they might have been taken from a list of model speeches in The Wife's Guide to Conduct. Jude knew the quality of every vibration in Sue's voice, could read every symptom of her mental condition, and he was convinced that she was unhappy, although she had not been a month married. But her rushing away thus from home to see the last of a relative whom she had hardly known in her life proved nothing, for Sue, naturally, did such things as those. "Well, you have my good wishes now, as always, Mrs. Phillotson." She reproached him by a glance. "No, you are not Mrs. Phillotson," murmured Jude. "You are dear, free Sue Bridehead, only you don't know it. Wifedom has not yet squashed up and digested you in its vast maw as an atom which has no further individuality." Sue put on a look of being offended till she answered, "Nor has husbandom you, so far as I can see." "But it has," he said, shaking his head sadly. When they reached the lone cottage under the firs between the brown house and Mary Green, in which Jude and Arabella had lived and quarreled, he turned to look at it. A squalid family lived there now. He could not help saying to Sue, "That's the house my wife and I occupied the whole of the time we lived together. I brought her home to that house." She looked at it. "That to you was what the schoolhouse at Shaston is to me." "Yes, but I was not very happy there, as you are in yours." She closed her lips in retortive silence, and they walked some way till she glanced at him to see how he was taking it. "Of course, I may have exaggerated your happiness. One never knows," he continued blandly. "Don't think that, Jude, for a moment, even though you may have said it to sting me. He's as good to me as a man can be, and gives me perfect liberty, which elderly husbands don't do in general. If you think I am not happy because he's too old for me, you are wrong. I don't think anything against him to you, dear. And you won't say things to distress me, will you?" "I will not." He said no more, but he knew that for some cause or other, in taking Phillotson as a husband, Sue felt that she had done what she ought not to have done. They plunged into the concave field on the other side of which rose the village, the field wherein Jude had received a thrashing from the farmer many years earlier. On ascending to the village and approaching the house, they found Mrs. Edlin standing at the door, who at the sight of them lifted her hands deprecatingly. "She's downstairs, if you'll believe me," cried the widow. "Out of bed she got, and nothing could turn her. What will come out it, I don't know." On entering, there indeed by the fireplace sat the old woman, wrapped in blankets, and turning upon them a countenance like that of Sebastiano's Lazarus. They must have looked their amazement, for she said in a hollow voice, "Ah, scared ye have I. I wasn't going to bide up there no longer to please nobody. 'Tis more than flesh and blood can bear to be ordered to do this and that by a feller that don't know half as well as you do yourself. Ah, you'll rue marrying as well as he," she added, turning to Sue. "All our family do, and nearly all everybody else's. You should have done as I did, you simpleton. And Phillotson, the schoolmaster of all men, what made ye marry him?" "What makes most women marry, aunt." "Ah, you mean to say you love the man?" "I don't mean to say anything definite." "Do ye love him?" "Don't ask me, aunt. I can mind the man very well, a very civil, honorable liver, but Lord, I don't want to wound your feelings. But there be certain men here and there that no woman of any niceness can stomach. I should have said he was one. I don't say so now, since you must have known better than I, but that's what I should have said." Sue jumped up and went out. Jude followed her and found her in the outhouse crying. "Don't cry, dear," said Jude in distress. "She means well, but is very crusty and queer now, you know." "Oh, no, it isn't that," said Sue, trying to dry her eyes. "I don't mind her roughness one bit." "What is it, then?" "It is that what she says is true. God." "What, you don't like him?" asked Jude. "I don't mean that," she said hastily, "that I ought, perhaps I ought not to have married." He wondered if she had really been going to say that at first. They went back, and the subject was smoothed over, and her aunt took rather kindly to Sue, telling her that not many young women newly married would have come so far to see a sick old crone like her. In the afternoon Sue prepared to depart, Jude hiring a neighbor to drive her to Alfredson. "I'll go with you to the station if you like," he said. She would not let him. The man came round with the trap, and Jude helped her into it, perhaps with unnecessary attention, for she looked at him prohibitively. "I suppose I may come to see you some day when I am back again at Melchester," he half-crossly observed. She bent down and said softly, "No, dear, you are not to come yet. I don't think you are in a good mood." "Very well," said Jude. "Goodbye." "Goodbye." She waved her hand and was gone. "She's right. I won't go," he murmured. He passed the evening and following days in mortifying by every possible means his wish to see her, nearly starving himself in attempts to extinguish by fasting his passionate tendency to love her. He read sermons on discipline and hunted up passages in church history that treated of the ascetics of the second century. Before he returned from Mary Green to Melchester, there arrived a letter from Arabella. The sight of it revived a stronger feeling of self-condemnation for his brief return to her society than for his attachment to Sue. The letter, he perceived, bore a London postmark instead of the Christminster one. Arabella informed him that a few days after their parting in the morning at Christminster, she had been surprised by an affectionate letter from her Australian husband, formerly manager of the hotel in Sydney. He had come to England on purpose to find her, and had taken a free, fully licensed public in Lambeth, where he wished her to join him in conducting the business, which was likely to be a very thriving one, the house being situated in an excellent, densely populated, gin-drinking neighborhood, and already doing a trade of £200 a month, which could be easily doubled. As he had said that he loved her very much still, and implored her to tell him where she was, and as they had only parted in a slight tiff, and as her engagement in Christminster was only temporary, she had just gone to join him as he urged. She could not help feeling that she belonged to him more than to Jude, since she had properly married him and had lived with him much longer than with her first husband. In thus wishing Jude goodbye, she bore him no ill will, and trusted he would not turn upon her, a weak woman, and inform against her, and bring her to ruin now that she had a chance of improving her circumstances and leading a genteel life.
Chapter 10. Jude returned to Melchester, which had the questionable recommendation of being only a dozen and a half miles from his Sue's now permanent residence. At first he felt that this nearness was a distinct reason for not going southward at all, but Christminster was too sad a place to bear, while the proximity of Shaston to Melchester might afford him the glory of worsting the enemy in a close engagement, such as was deliberately sought by the priests and virgins of early church, who, disdaining an ignominious flight from temptation, became even chamber partners with impunity. Jude did not pause to remember that, in the laconic words of the historian, insulted nature sometimes vindicated her rights in such circumstances. He now returned with feverish desperation to his study for the priesthood, in the recognition that the single-mindedness of his aims and his fidelities to the cause had been more than questionable of late. His passion for Sue troubled his soul, yet his lawful abandonment to the society of Arabella for 12 hours seemed instinctively a worse thing, even though she had not told him of her Sydney husband till afterwards. He had, he verily believed, overcome all tendency to fly to liquor, which indeed he had never done from taste, but merely as an escape from intolerable misery of mind. Yet he perceived with despondency that, taken all around, he was a man of too many passions to make a good clergyman. The utmost he could hope for, that in life of a constant internal warfare between flesh and spirit, the former might not always be victorious. As a hobby, auxiliary to his readings in divinity, he developed his slight skill in church music and thorough bass till he could join in part singing from notation with some accuracy. A mile or two from Melchester, there was a restored village church to which Jude had originally gone to fix the new columns and capitals. By this means, he had become acquainted with the organist, and the ultimate result was that he joined the choir as a bass voice. He walked out to this parish twice every Sunday, and sometimes in the week. One evening, about Easter, the choir met for practice, and a new hymn, which Jude had heard of as being by a Wessex composer, was to be tried and prepared for the following week. It turned out to be a strangely emotional composition. As they all sang it over and over again, its harmonies grew upon Jude, and moved him exceedingly. When they had finished, he went round to the organist to make inquiries. The score was in manuscript, the name of the composer being at the head, together with the title of the hymn, The Foot of the Cross. "Yes," said the organist, "he is a local man. He is a professional musician at Kennetbridge, between here and Christminster. The vicar knows him. He was brought up and educated in Christminster traditions, which accounts for the quality of this piece. I think he plays in the large church there, and has a surpliced choir. He comes to Melchester sometimes, and once tried to get the cathedral organ when the post was vacant. The hymn is getting about everywhere this Easter." As he walked humming the air on his way home, Jude fell to musing on its composer and the reasons why he composed. What a man of sympathies he must be! Perplexed and harassed as he himself was about Sue and Arabella, and troubled as he was his conscience by the complication of his position, how he would like to know that man! "He, of all men, would understand my difficulties," said the impulsive Jude. "If there were any person in the world to choose as a confidant, this composer would be the one, for he must have suffered, and throbbed, and yearned." In brief, ill as he could afford the time and money for the journey, Folly resolved, like the child that he was, to go to Kennetbridge the very next Sunday. He duly started early in the morning, for it was only by a series of crooked railways that he could get to the town. About midday he reached it, and crossing the bridge into the quaint old borough, he inquired for the house of the composer. They told him it was a brick building some little way further on, also that the gentleman himself had just passed along the street not 5 minutes before. "Which way?" said Jude with alacrity. "Straight along, homeward from the church." Jude hastened on, and soon had the pleasure of observing a man in a black coat and a black slouched felt hat no considerable distance ahead. Stretching out his legs, yet more widely, he stalked after. "A hungry soul in pursuit of a full soul," he said. "I must speak to that man." He could not, however, overtake the musician before he had entered his own house, and then arose the question if this were an expedient time to call. Whether or not he decided to do so there and then, the distance home being too great for him to wait till late in the afternoon. This man of soul would understand scant ceremony, and might be quite a perfect adviser in a case in which earthly and illegitimate passion had cunningly obtained entrance into his heart through the opening afforded for religion. Jude accordingly rang the bell, and was admitted. The musician came to him in a moment, and being respectably dressed, good-looking, and frank in manner, Jude obtained a favorable reception. He was nevertheless conscious that there would be a certain awkwardness in explaining his errand. "I have been singing in the choir of a little church near Melchester," he said, "and we have this week practiced the foot of the cross, which I understand, sir, that you composed." "I did, a year or so ago." "I like it. I think it's supremely beautiful." "Ah, well, other people have said so, too. Yes, there's money in it, if I could only see about getting it published. I have other compositions to go with it, too. I wish I could bring them out, for I haven't made a 5-pound note out of any of them yet. These publishing people, they want the copyright of an obscure composer's work, such as mine is, for almost less than I should have to pay a person for making a fair manuscript copy of the score. The one you speak of I have lent to various friends about here and Melchester, and so it has got to be sung a little. But the music is a poor staff to lean on. I am giving it up entirely. You must go into a trade if you want to make money nowadays. The wine business is what I'm thinking of. This is my forthcoming list. It is not issued yet, but you can take one." He handed Jude an advertisement list of several pages in a booklet shape, ornamentally margined with a red line, in which were set forth the various clarets, champagnes, ports, sherries, and other wines with which he purposed to initiate his new ventures. It took Jude more than by surprise that the man with the soul was thus and thus, and he felt that he could not open up his confidences. They talked a little longer, but constrainedly, for when the musician found that Jude was a poor man, his manner changed from what it had been while Jude's appearance and address deceived him as to his position and pursuits. Jude stammered out something about his feelings in wishing to congratulate the author on such an exalted composition, and took an embarrassed leave. All the way home, by the slow Sunday train, sitting in the fireless waiting rooms on this cold spring day, he was depressed enough at his simplicity in taking such a journey. But no sooner did he reach his Melchester lodging than he found awaiting him a letter which had arrived that morning a few minutes after he had left the house. It was a contrite little note from Sue, in which she had said, with sweet humility, that she felt she had been horrid in telling him he was not to come to see her, that she despised herself for having been so conventional, and that he was to be sure to come by the 11:45 train that very Sunday and have dinner with them at 1:30. Jude almost tore his hair at having missed this letter till it was too late to act upon its contents, but he had chastened himself considerably of late, and at last his chimerical expedition to Kennetbridge really did seem to have been another special intervention of Providence to keep him away from temptation. But a growing impatience of faith, which he had noticed in himself more than once of late, made him pass over in ridicule the idea that God sent people on fool's errands. He longed to see her. He was angry at having missed her, and he wrote instantly, telling her what had happened, and saying he had not enough patience to wait till the following Sunday, but would come any day in the week that she liked to name. Since he wrote a little over ardently, Sue, as her manner was, delayed her reply till Thursday before Good Friday, when she said he might come that afternoon if he wished, this being the earliest day on which she could welcome him, for she was now assistant teacher in her husband's school. Jude therefore got leave from the cathedral works at the trifling expense of a stoppage of pay, and went.
Part 4 at Shaston. Hardy begins with a quote from John Milton. "Whoso prefers either matrimony or other ordinance before the good of man and the plain exigence of charity, let him profess Papist or Protestant or what he will, he is no better than a Pharisee." And now our first reader in Part 4 is Stuart Jonap.
Chapter 1. Shaston, the ancient British Palador, from whose foundation first such strange reports arise, as Drayton sang it, was and is, in itself, the city of a dream. Vague imaginings of its castle, its three mints, its magnificent Absidal Abbey, the chief glory of South Wessex, its 12 churches, its shrines, chantries, hospitals, its gabled freestone mansions, all now ruthlessly swept away, throw the visitor even against his will into a pensive melancholy, which the stimulating atmosphere and limitless landscape around him can scarcely dispel. The spot was the burial place of a king and a queen, of abbots and abbesses, saints and bishops, knights and squires. The bones of King Edward the Martyr, carefully removed hither for holy preservation, brought Shaston a renown which made it the resort of pilgrims from every part of Europe, and enabled it to maintain a reputation extending far beyond English shores. To this fair creation of the great Middle Age, the dissolution was, as historians tell us, the death knell. With the destruction of the enormous abbey, the whole place collapsed in a general ruin. The martyrs' bones met with the fate of the sacred pile that held them, and not a stone is now left to tell where they lie. The natural picturesqueness and singularity of the town still remain, but strange to say, these qualities, which were noted by many writers in ages when scenic beauty is said to have been unappreciated, are passed over in this, and one of the queerest and quaintest spots in England stands virtually unvisited today. It has a unique position on the summit of a steep and imposing scarp, rising on the north, south, and west sides of the borough out of the deep alluvial vale of Blackmoor. The view of the Castle Green over these three counties of verdant pasture, South, Mid, and Nether Wessex, being as sudden a surprise to the unexpectant traveler's eyes as the medicinal air is to his lungs. Impossible to a railway, it can best be reached on foot, next best by light vehicles, and it is hardly accessible to these, but by some sort of isthmus on the northeast that connects it with the high chalk tableland on that side. Such is, and such was, the now world-forgotten Shaston or Palador. Its situation rendered water the great want of the town, and within living memory horses, donkeys, and men may have been seen toiling up the winding ways to the top of the height, laden with tubs and barrels filled from the wells beneath the mountain, and hawkers retailing their contents at the price of a halfpenny a bucketful. This difficulty in the water supply, together with two other odd facts, namely that the chief graveyard slopes up as steeply as a roof behind the church, and that in former times the town passed through a curious period of corruption, conventual and domestic, gave rise to the saying that Shaston was remarkable for three consolations to a man, such as the world afforded not elsewhere. It was a place where the churchyard lay nearer heaven than the church steeple, where beer was more plentiful than water, and where there were more wanton women than honest wives and maids. It was also said that after the Middle Ages the inhabitants were too poor to pay their priest, and hence were compelled to pull down their churches and refrain altogether from the public worship of God, a necessity which they bemoaned over their cups in the settles of their inns on Sunday afternoons. In those days the Shastonians were apparently not without a sense of humor. There was another peculiarity, this is a modern one, which Shaston appeared to owe to its site. It was the resting place and headquarters of the proprietors of wandering vans, shows, shooting galleries, and other itinerant concerns, whose business lay largely at fairs and markets, as strange wild birds are seen assembled on some lofty promontory, meditatively pausing for longer flights, or to return by the course they followed thither. So here, in this cliff town, stood, in stultified silence, the yellow and green caravans bearing names not local, as if surprised by a change in the landscape so violent as to hinder their further progress. And here they usually remained all the winter, till they turned to seek again their old tracks in the following spring. It was to this breezy and whimsical spot that Jude ascended from the nearest station for the first time in his life, about 4 o'clock one afternoon, and entering on the summit of the peak after a toilsome climb, past the first houses of the aerial town, and drew towards the schoolhouse. The hour was too early. The pupils were still in school, humming small like a swarm of gnats, and he withdrew a few steps along Abbey Walk, whence he regarded the spot which fate had made the home of all he loved best in the world. In front of the schools, which were extensive and stone-built, grew two enormous beeches with smooth, mouse-colored trunks, as such trees will only grow on chalk uplands. Within the mullioned and transomed window, he could see the black, brown, and flaxen crowns of the scholars over the sills, and to pass the time away he walked down to the level terrace where the abbey gardens once had spread, his heart throbbing in spite of him. Unwilling to enter till the children were dismissed, he remained here till young voices could be heard in the open air, and girls in white pinafores over red and blue frocks appeared dancing along the pass, which the abbess, prioress, sub-prioress, and 50 nuns had demurely paced 3 centuries earlier. Retracing his steps, he found that he had waited too long and that Sue had gone out into the town at the heels of the last scholar, Mr. Philiston, having been absent all the afternoon at a teacher's meeting at Shottsford. Jude went into the empty schoolroom and sat down. The girl who was sweeping the floor having informed him that Mrs. Philiston would be back again in a few minutes. A piano stood near, actually the old piano that Philiston had possessed at Mary Green, and though the dark afternoon almost prevented him seeing the notes, Jude touched them in a humble way, and could not help modulating into the hymn which had so affected him in the previous week. A figure moved behind him, and thinking it was still the girl with the broom, Jude took no notice, till the person came close and laid her fingers lightly upon his bass hand. The imposed hand was a little one he seemed to know, and he turned. "Don't stop," said Sue. "I like it. I learnt it before I left Melchester. They used to play it in the training school. I can't strum before you. Play it for me. Oh, well, I don't mind. Sue sat down, and her rendering of the piece, though not remarkable, seemed divine as compared with his own. She, like him, was evidently touched, to her own surprise, by the recalled air, and when she had finished and he moved his hand towards hers, it met his halfway. Jude grasped it, just as he had done before her marriage. "It is odd," she said in a voice quite changed, "that I should care about that air because..." "Because what?" "I'm not that sort, quite." "Not easily moved?" "I didn't quite mean that." "Oh, but you are one of that sort, for you are just like me at heart." "But not at head." She played on and suddenly turned around, and by an unpremeditated instinct, each clasped the other's hand again. She uttered a forced little laugh as she relinquished his quickly. "How funny," she said. "I wonder what we both did that for." "I suppose because we are both alike, as I said before. Not in our thoughts, perhaps a little in our feelings." "And as they rule thoughts, isn't it enough to make one blaspheme that the composer of that hymn is one of the most commonplace men I've ever met?" "What? You know him?" "I went to see him." "Oh, you goose, to do just what I should have done. Why did you?" "Because we are not alike," he said dryly. "Now we'll have some tea," said Sue. "Shall we have it here instead of in my house? It is no trouble to get the kettle and things brought in. We don't live at the school, you know, but in that ancient dwelling across the way called Oak Grove Place. It is so antique and dismal that it depresses me dreadfully. Such houses are very well to visit, but not to live in. I feel crushed into the earth by the weight of so many previous lives there spent. In a new place like these schools, there is only your own life to support. Sit down, and I'll tell Ada to bring the tea things across." He waited in the light of the stove, the door of which she flung open before going out, and when she returned, followed by the maiden with tea, they sat down by the same light, assisted by the blue rays of a spirit lamp under the brass kettle on the stand. "This is just one of your wedding presents to me," she said, signifying the latter. "Yes," said Jude. The kettle of his gift sang with some satire in its note to his mind, and to change the subject he said, "Do you know of any good readable edition of the uncanonical books of the New Testament? You don't read them in school, I suppose." "Oh dear, no. 'Twould alarm the neighborhood." "Yes, there is one. I'm not familiar with it now, though I was interested in it when my former friend was alive. Cowper's Apocryphal Gospels." "That sounds like what I want." His thoughts, however, reverted with a twinge to the former friend by whom she meant, as he knew, the university comrade of her earlier days. He wondered if she talked of him to Philiston. "The Gospel of Nicodemus is very nice," she went on to keep him from his jealous thoughts, which she read clearly, as she always did. Indeed, when they talked on an indifferent subject, as now, there was ever a second silent conversation passing between their emotions, so perfect was the reciprocity between them. It is quite like the genuine article, all cut up into verses, too, so that it is like one of the other evangelists read in a dream, when things are the same, yet not the same. "But Jude, do you take an interest in those questions still? Are you getting up apologetica?" "Yes, I'm reading divinity harder than ever." She regarded him curiously. "Why do you look at me like that?" said Jude. "Oh, why do you want to know?" "Well, I'm sure you can tell me anything I may be ignorant of in that subject. You must have learnt a lot from everything from your dear dead friend." "We won't get on to that now," she coaxed. "Will you be carving out that church again next week, where you learnt the pretty hymn?" "Yes, perhaps." "Well, that will be very nice. Shall I come and see you there? It is in this direction, and I could come any afternoon by train for half an hour." "No, don't come." "What? Aren't we going to be friends then any longer as we used to be?" "No." "I didn't know that. I thought you were always going to be kind to me." "No, I'm not." "What have I done then? I am sure I thought we two..." The tremolo in her voice caused her to break off. "Sue, I sometimes think you are a flirt," said he abruptly. There was a momentary pause till she suddenly jumped up, and to his surprise, he saw by the kettle flame that her face was flushed. "I can't talk to you any longer, Jude," she said, the tragic contralto note having come back as of old. "It is getting too dark to stay together like this after playing morbid Good Friday tunes that make one feel what one shouldn't. We mustn't sit and talk in this way any more. Yes, you must go away, for you mistake me. I'm very much the reverse of what you say so cruelly." "Oh, Jude, it was so cruel to say that. Yet I can't tell you the truth. I should shock you by letting you know how I give way to my impulses, and how I feel that I shouldn't have been provided with attractiveness, unless it were meant to be exercised. Some women's love of being loved is insatiable, and so often is their love of loving. and in this last case they may find that they can't give it continuously to the chamber officer appointed by the bishop's license to receive it. But you are so straightforward, Jude, that you can't understand me. Now you must go. I'm sorry my husband is not at home. Are you? I perceive I have said that in mere convention. Honestly, I don't think I am sorry. It does not matter either way, sad to say. And as they had overdone the grasp of hands some time sooner, she touched his fingers, but lightly, when he went out now. He had hardly gone from the door, when with a dissatisfied look, she jumped on a form and opened the iron casement of a window beneath which he was passing in the path without. "When do you leave here to catch your train, Jude?" she asked. He looked up in some surprise. "The coach that runs to meet it goes in 3/4 of an hour or so." "What will you do with yourself for the time?" "Oh, I wander about, I suppose. Perhaps I shall go and sit in the old church." "It does seem hard of me to pack you off so. You have thought enough of churches, heaven knows, without going into one in the dark. Stay there." "Where?" "Where you are. I can talk to you better like this than when you were inside. It was so kind and tender of you to give up half a day's work to come and see me. You are Joseph, the dreamer of dreams, dear Jude, and a tragic Don Quixote. And sometimes you are at St. Stephen, who, while they were stoning him, could see heaven opened. Oh, my poor friend and comrade, you'll suffer yet." Now that the high window sill was between them, so that he could not get at her, she seemed not to mind indulging in a frankness she had feared at close quarters. "I've been thinking," she continued, still in the tone of one brimful of feeling, "that the social mold civilization fits us into have no more relation to our actual shapes than the conventional shapes of the constellations have to the real star patterns. I am called Mrs. Richard Philiston, living a calm, wedded life with the counterpart of that name. But I am not really Mrs. Richard Philiston, but a woman tossed about, all alone, with abhorrent passions and unaccountable antipathies. Now you mustn't wait longer, or you will lose the coach. Come and see me again. You must come to the house then." "Yes," said Jude. "When shall it be?" "Tomorrow week. Goodbye, goodbye." She stretched out her hand and stroked his forehead pitifully, just once. Jude said goodbye and went away into the darkness. Passing along Bimbord Street, he thought he heard the wheels of the coach departing, and truly enough, when he reached the Duke's Arms in the marketplace, the coach had gone. It was impossible for him to get to the station on foot in time for this train, and he'd settled himself perforce to wait for the next, the last to Melchester that night. He wandered about a while, obtained something to eat, and then, having another half-hour on his hands, his feet involuntarily took him through the venerable graveyard of Trinity Church, with its avenues of limes, in the direction of the schools again. They were entirely in darkness. She had said she lived over the way at Old Grove Place, a house which he soon discovered from her description of its antiquity. A glimmering candlelight shone from a front window, the shutters being yet unclosed. He could see the interior clearly, the floor sinking a couple of steps below the road without, which had become raised during the centuries since the house was built. Sue, evidently just come in, as standing with her hat on in this front parlor or sitting room, whose walls were lined with wainscoting of paneled oak reaching from floor to ceiling, the latter being crossed by huge molded beams only a little way above her head. The mantelpiece was of the same heavy description, carved with Jacobean pilasters and scrollwork. The centuries did, indeed, ponderously overhang a young wife who passed her time here. She had opened a rosewood workbox and was looking at a photograph. Having contemplated it a little while, she pressed it against her bosom and put it again in its place. Then, becoming aware that she had not obscured the window, she came forward to do so, candle in hand. It was too dark for her to see Jude without, but he could see her face distinctly, and there was an unmistakable tearfulness about the dark, long-lashed eyes. She closed the shutters, and Jude turned away to pursue his solitary journey home. "Whose photograph was she looking at?" he said. He had once given her his, but she had others, he knew. Yet it was his, surely. He knew he should go to see her again, according to her invitation. Those earnest men he read of, the saints whom Sue, with gentle irreverence, called his demigods, would have shunned such encounters if they doubted their own strength, but he could not. He might fast and pray during the whole interval, but the human was more powerful in him than the divine.
Well, that's it for this program of readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Check back with us at the same time next week. We'll read another episode. Meanwhile, thanks from me. Thanks from today's readers. Glad to have you tuning in. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a good day.